You're listening to WRFI Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. And our guest on this hour of the Made of Clay Report is Mara Alper. It's good to have you here this morning.
Thanks.
I just made a glitch with the board, and we are back on the air. So Mara, tell me, who are you? What do we need to know to start this conversation?
Well, I love that you ask this question as the opening. It's such a big question. And I've actually been thinking about it in a different way now, because I'm 2 weeks away from retiring after 30 years of college teaching.
Wow.
And so I've been thinking how we define ourselves often, usually, by what we do, which is, of course, important.
Mm-hmm.
But I was thinking if there was something, like an overall thing, not that has made me who I am, or that who I am in terms of bigger things. Like, I think curiosity has been a really important driving force in my life, and I think it's led me to so many different things just by being curious about stuff. And also, I'm very grateful for the gift of being creative. I don't take any credit for it. It's just something that we get.
Comes easily for
you.
Yeah.
But I think I've made a commitment to using it, and I think that being creative has completely shaped my life. So I'd say that's an essential part of who I am.
I'm looking forward to hearing about how that works. Yeah. Yeah. And so those are qualities. And only a handful of people over the years have walked in and introduced themselves by the qualities that they aspire to, or that they want.
I think partly I moved up here from New York City. I'm from New York, born there. I lived there forever till I moved here in 98. And in New York City, when you meet people, pretty much after your name, the first thing that they say is, what do you do?
Right.
And I moved up here, and I thought I still had a what I did thing, but I just thought I didn't want that to be my opening question for people. And people up here, that wasn't their opening question either.
So help me, what was the difference here, and what did you say?
I don't know. Here people, it's not what do you do. I mean, it might be, are you connected to one of the colleges? That would be a more likely opening question here.
Right.
But it was more, you know, just kind of having conversations and letting it
oftentimes
evolve.
It's what brought you here.
Mm-hmm.
Or you know, it's, you know, which, how do you like it here?
Pretty much seems to be love or money. Seems to be the two things that bring people to Ithaca.
Right.
A job or a person, you know.
Right.
So,
but
I like to ask people how they spend their time, you know, and especially as people retire, it's a better way to phrase the question anyway. But just how do you spend your time? And then it is what your work, but it's all these other things too.
Right, and it's the one thing worth more than money to most people is time, and that gets at something extremely important.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's really neat. You brought some music with you.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we're going to open with the Dave Holland Quartet, the Conference of the Birds. Do you want to say anything about that before we play it, or just let it be?
Yeah, I love it. I love jazz. It's one of my favorite pieces. It just has a beautiful quality to it. And I dance. I love dancing. And so this is something that I just love dancing to. And Conference of the Birds, I found out afterwards, is a Sufi expression. But I didn't know that when I fell in love with the song.
Uh-huh.
So I think it captures the spirit of birds. And I'm very drawn to flying. And so this is part of that.
And it moves in very different ways through the piece. So we'll listen to 2 or 3 minutes. Okay.
Okay. Thank you.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca. This is the Made of Clay Report, and our guest on this edition is Mara Alper. So, Mara, you're 2 weeks away from retirement. Looking back on your life, what are some of the experiences that you really kind of value now because they have helped make your life make sense? And what helped make you who you are now?
Well, I've been teaching college full-time for 30 years, but I started teaching when I was 19, when I was still in college. And I was a double major in theater and English, and I did theater with kids. And it was kids who were in a residential home. They were, you know, had family problems, so they were together. Mm-hmm. And I brought a script, and I had them audition and do, you know, like the normal things you do. And I saw that some of the kids were helping the other kids who couldn't actually read that well, but they were helping each other so they could do this audition, and it just made a really strong impression on me. And uh-huh. we did the play, and it was good, but I think I understood, well, one, that reading was an issue for a lot of people,
right?
Which, since I'd always read, I never really thought about it. It was probably the first time I encountered right. that. But seeing the kids helping each other just struck a chord in me. Mm-hmm. And so actually I ended up teaching second grade in the South Bronx for a few years right after college. Then I started my own kind of reading through the arts program, doing puppets and drama and video. Port-a-Pack videos were just starting then. Uh-huh. And so the kids were the kids not doing well in classes, and they got taken out of the class in order to do these reading things. But they were all arts-based, so they all would either write a script or something that involved writing. Mm-hmm. That would be their reading material, and then their reward was they get to make the puppets or do the play or do the video.
Right.
And so it was really good motivation. And it was very much of, you know, it's called the language experience approach to reading, and it was very much about them working, collaborating with each other. And so I've just continued teaching. I've always taught things in the arts, always things about creativity and encouraging people to find their own way in their creativity. And from second grade through high school, through graduate school, pre-K, and then finally I started college teaching part-time. And once I did that, I just said, oh, this is my place.
You found your calling.
Yeah.
Yeah. Where did you start teaching college?
I taught as an adjunct at Pratt uh-huh. Institute in New York, an art school, which right. was a great place to teach.
Art and design and all this yeah. and other stuff. Yeah,
and
yeah,
I taught video and filmmaking, which I was doing both. And also I'd done animation because I was a puppeteer for a long time, and I made an animated puppet film. So those were the three areas I started with. Mm-hmm. And then I was at SUNY New Paltz for about 8 years doing video, and then at NYU as a visiting artist for a year, and then up here for 19 years, wow. since 1998 at Ithaca College, doing video making. But the last few years, I've been very concerned about water my whole life, since my 20s. And the last few years, I started designing interdisciplinary courses about water.
Oh, really?
And Ithaca College has been really supportive of it. So I now have three courses, and I'd say a lot of my creative energy has gone into the water areas now.
What caught your attention with water?
Well, in my 20s, I don't know what I read or saw, and that would have been in like the 70s.
When we were having the first Earth Day and all of these kind of
yes.
And the Hudson River Revival stuff started.
Yeah. And yeah. I was actually in the first Earth Day. I made a puppet of the world. It was a big globe with arms. It was a rod puppet, and it was talking about what people should do and everything. And so it was down at South Street Seaport, and it was uh-huh. the very first Earth Day. That's probably it. But I just things I read about water made me very concerned about mm-hmm. water. And I just felt kind of, was that Robert Frost poem? Some say the world will end in fire. Some say
in
ice.
From what I've tasted of desire. I'm one right. of those who favor fire. And I can never remember the rest of it, but yes.
So something about that water, and it wasn't the ice part. I just right. felt that it was going to be scarcity of water that was going right. to be the most difficult thing humans were going to face. And I don't know why I just saw that way in my 20s. And I thought of going to law school. I actually took some preliminary law boards to do ocean mm-hmm. law, found some schools in Florida and Oregon. Then I went to a law school bookstore and looked at, it was at NYU because I lived in the village in New York, and looked at the books, and it was the thinnest paper I've ever seen and the smallest type I've ever seen. I just thought, I can't read this stuff for 3 years. So I didn't. Right. I kept doing my writer, producer, director mm-hmm. stuff.
But the water stayed as an interest.
It stayed, and then maybe 10 years ago when it started to really surface again, you know, somewhat in the news, I just thought, well, I didn't do it then. I didn't know how to pursue it. I have to do it now. Mm-hmm. And what can I do? And I thought, well, I'm a teacher. I'm just going to start teaching classes about it. So that's what I did. And I call in guest experts who come and speak in my classes, or I do one online class, and the guest experts come from all over the world and mm-hmm. visit with the students and answer their questions.
And what are the topics about water? What do you take on? What do you want the students to learn, and what are you offering?
My primary goal is for them to not take water for granted. I figure mm-hmm. that's step one.
Right.
And for those of us in this country, most of us in this country, that's all we know, is to take water for granted.
Unless you live in the West, where there are
right.
major shortages. But yeah.
Right.
Absolutely.
Right. Well, okay, I should say in this region.
Yeah, no, not this is a country. Water lush. Yeah, yeah,
yeah. But yeah, the whole East, well, yeah, the Northeast, definitely where I'm from. But we take it for granted until we can't mm-hmm. anymore. And so that, and then learn to appreciate and respect water, because I figure that's the first step. If you can't do those things, then you're not going to ever do anything else about it. My hidden agenda, which is not very hidden at all, is for them to become politically active or active in some way. Mm-hmm. And you know, the freshman course I teach is called The Power of Water. And so I do it, I start with water in the body, mm-hmm. which they're kind of fascinated with. And Uriel Carpenter, who I know has come here, yes. is my guest expert for that. And then goes out to water around us, so the watershed, the wetlands, the lakes, the ponds. And we do some field trips and, you know, understand what a watershed is, which most people don't know. It's the collecting area for all the water in the area. And then out slightly bigger to rivers, you know, U.S. rivers, then mm-hmm. we do global rivers and all the issues there, and then to the oceans. So water, it's such a huge subject that you can, right. you know, you have to pick and choose what you do. But then the students also choose their own topics, too, you know, to go off onto, the, you know, for their last project. So it just opens their eyes, and in so many ways, I'm like the bearer of bad news. I kind of feel like Cassandra sometime. Like,
why?
Well, most of the students, you know, have lived with plenty of water and not mm-hmm. had to deal with not having it. Occasionally, it will be in the news, like Flint, Michigan. People are aware of that. Certainly, climate change, people are aware of that. But so many of the issues about water are not talked about or mm-hmm. not known. Mm-hmm. And so for people to really face that there's so many things going on, is hard. And the initial response with the freshmen when I, you know, bring up a lot of subjects, they'll say, well, the government will take care of that. The government will take care of that. Yeah, and so
isn't
that's...
there a scientific solution to that problem?
Yeah, or technology will fix it. Yeah. Right. And so that's the point of disillusionment. I have to say, well, kids, that would be great, but that's not how it works. And then we get into all of that.
Yeah. Did you know the poet Archie Ammons?
Mm-mm.
He's based at Cornell. He had a poem called "If Anything Will Level With You, Water Will." And you know how, you know, they use water levels to make all those big buildings and stuff, because back when you didn't have a lot of other techniques, that's what you do to get a level mm-hmm. assessment. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, levels still are water. There's many, that little bubble
well,
goes back
there,
and
there
forth.
There are bubbles, but also there's water in a tube where you let it settle so that both ends have mm-hmm. come to rest. Then they're mm-hmm. perfectly level across mm-hmm. a long distance.
Yeah, and I think a lot of our issues about water, they're not about... They're not done initially from evil. It's just water is a universal solvent. Water is amazing.
Yeah.
There's nothing like it. And so the fact that 200-300 years ago, everybody's just dumping all their stuff in water because it would, you know, purify
it. Take it away.
In all these religions, water is a purification mm-hmm. form. So, you know, now we're just learning. It's just kind of like learning about germs. You know, right. like learning that water can't do everything.
And it can't do everything, and we don't need to use it the way we have, because, you know, we really don't unless for other reasons you need to shower more than a couple of times a week, you probably could get away with once a week. And people, you know, when you have multiple bathrooms in houses that people use all the time, you know, you don't have to flush it every time. We waste a lot of water because we've come to expect to wash things in particular ways, and it's just kind of crazy. Right. That's just personal consumption. That's not even production.
And that's the big taking it for granted part, to not even think, to just be mindless about the faucet. One point I like to make is where there are faucets, there's wasted water. And like if you think of all the cultures where people have to carry water far distances, usually women, on their heads or on their backs, you don't waste water when you have to carry it that way. And I travel a lot, and I've been in a lot of places where that's true. And, you know, it's a different way of looking at things.
Right. And we had faucets, but but we had a cistern. And either the rain came and filled our cistern, or we had a truck that came and put water in the cistern. Otherwise, we didn't have water as a kid growing up because the well water was sulfur, and it was nearly not usable. So I grew up in an environment that was much more sensitive. You got a bath once a week on the weekend, and in a galvanized steel tub before we had a bathroom. It was a very different, and everybody had to use the same water twice. You know,
where did you grow up?
Northwest Missouri, on a self-sufficient / subsistent farm, the sixth of seven children. Eventually, we did put a bathroom in the house, and we did become a little more wasteful. But we were very conscious.
Yeah.
Once you've lived at that kind of edge, you never step back.
Right. I think I got it from camping because I used to go camping a lot, and then you have to. It's not, you don't have to haul it very far, you know, but you have to haul your water. So.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh. Let me do the station ID, and you think about what music we should play next.
Okay.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca. This is the Made of Clay Report, and our guest on this edition is Mara Alper. So, Mara, where should we go?
I don't know. None of these things fit with the topics we've been talking about.
Next topic is, what's your next passion? You know, where are we headed next in this conversation?
Well, the song is next. Ours Is a Simple Faith is the next song, just because it's beautiful.
Yes, and by Mustard's Retreat. I'd never heard of this song before. It's a beautiful one.
Hello, we are Mustard's Retreat.
This song is called Our Worries is a Simple Faith. Our Worries is a Simple Faith. Life is a short embrace, heaven is in this place, every day. Hope is the ground we till, make each day what you will, thankful for dreams fulfilled, every day. No room in this heart for fear, no judgment day drawing near. Trust that inner voice you hear every day. Life's not a goal or race, it's about heart and faith and living a life of grace every day. A short embrace, heaven is in this place, every day. Hope is the ground we till, make each day what you will, thankful for dreams fulfilled, every day. An open hand, making an honest stand, rooted here in the land, every day. Live in the mystery, seeking the harmony here between you and me, every day. faith. Life is a short embrace. Heaven is in this place. Every day, hope is the ground we till. Make each day what you will. Thankful for dreams fulfilled. Every day, ours is a simple thing. Life is a short embrace. Heaven is in this place. Every day, hope is the ground we till. Make each day one.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report, and our guest on this hour is Mara Alper, and that was Mustard's Retreat, Ours is a Simple Faith.
I think I chose that song because of its optimism and just the beauty. And there's a wonderful quote from Wendell Berry, or it's a part of one of his longer poems, and says, "Be joyful though you've considered all the facts."
I just read that last. Maybe I read it on one of your emails. Is that your tag?
I think, you know, just all these things about water and all the issues in the world, like, you know, we still have to live our daily lives, and 99% of the time, our daily life is fine. But right. It's the anticipation or the fear about what's going to happen. So I love that quote. It gets me through a lot.
Yeah, and actually, it's a great lead-in to the question we just talked about. How has life changed you in ways you wouldn't have anticipated and possibly wouldn't have chosen? what have been some of the turning points that you've had to be resilient?
Yeah. For? Well, when I'm an introspective person, and when I've looked back over, you know, my life, like you mapping it, there are two points, one from childhood and one midlife. When I was a child, I had kidney disease. From when I was 6 to 10, I had nephrosis. And part of it, I had to go into New York City for blood tests every 3 weeks. And we're in the subway. Usually we drove in, but we're in the subway, and there's an ad up at the top of the subway. And it had these twin boys, and one of them was normal size, and the other was, you know, very swollen. Like, you retain water from this, you get right. swollen. And it said, nephrosis claims half its victims, something like that. In other words, half of the people who have nephrosis die from it.
And you read this in the subway.
And I was 8.
Wow.
And I turned to my mother and I asked her if it was true. And she didn't answer immediately. But then she said yes. And, you know, looking back on that later in life, I realized how amazing it was that she said yes, because she was not somebody who really liked to deal with anything that was difficult. But she was honest. And what I...
Russ. When you're 8 years old and you read that sign, you deserve the truth.
Yeah, I guess so.
Yeah. I'm sorry, I interrupted you.
No, that's okay. That's a good thing to have said. When you're 8, you don't want to die. I mean, but all it meant to me then was, I wouldn't get to keep playing with my friends.
Right.
It wasn't, there was not much baggage on it. And I felt like, looking back on it, that I just was recently in this world. I'd only been in this world, this forum, 8 years, you know. So the loss was not as great. You know, it seems like it's scarier maybe later on. But I think that for me, facing death and accepting death and acknowledging death at such a young age really changed the course of my life in so many ways. I don't mind the idea of death. Dying, that's something else. That's hard.
It's a process,
and complicated.
It can be.
Physical, you know, discomfort. But death itself, I guess I have a Buddhist practice, and I think that, you know, I do believe in reincarnation. I've spent time in Bali and the Hindu religion, so I think that's part of it. But just that was definitely an important turning point for me.
So how did you make, I too have a death story. My father died when I was just almost 8. And I wrote a story about that a few years later. And I said, it was understood Dad was dead, but we didn't know what dead meant.
Mm.
And figuring out what dead meant was something kind of a journey for the next 10 or 20 years of my life. How did death figure in your life? How did you dance with it?
In my 20s, the Carlos Castaneda books were very popular, and one of the lines that stood out for me a great deal from that was to take death as your advisor. You had death sitting on your left shoulder, advising you how to live your life. And if you know that you'll die and accept that you'll die, then you make different choices in life. You know it's finite, and you proceed differently, I think, than if you're not looking at it.
So what were some of the choices that you made that were different because of that book, or do you remember?
I don't know. A million and one. So many that
it
I
accompanied
I,
you.
Yeah. Yeah, I think...
And how did your mother, I mean, you eventually recovered from it.
Right.
And were your kidneys restored? Or
I was in an experimental trial with cortisone, and so that worked. It went into remission.
And how did your, I mean, you also went to a very intense space with your mother. Did you ever go back there?
Well, my mother and I had an intense relationship, so we didn't need to go back to that to have intensity and complication.
I'm talking about. I'm talking about just
that
quality of life on the edge.
I don't think so. I don't think until after my father died, because when some of her friends started dying, you know, just she really couldn't talk about it or deal with it. You know, she had an aversion to death and talking about it. So it wasn't until my father died. And then, you know, we had 5 months before she also passed away. And so in there we had, you know, more of that connection.
But in some ways you had had your own relationship with death much earlier.
Yeah.
What has kept you excited in working as a teacher? What do you intend? I mean, you say you want them to become politicized, and that you want, I mean, water is a medium for raising an issue. But what in teaching, what keeps you? What has kept you in this profession from which you're about to retire? So maybe you're moving away from it. You don't want to talk so much about it. But what held you there for 30 years?
Well, mainly I've taught video, you know, making video and film. And I think just seeing people discover things in themselves, you know, seeing their, finding for themselves their potential and possibility and voice and to take risks. I think that's always an important thing.
You want them to be curious, too.
Yeah. Yeah. And because, like I said, I'm, you know, introspective and very dedicated to the interior world, you know, I try to find ways for them to do that that are comfortable for them, you know, because it's partly like that's your material and everything you've done up until this moment is something you can use in this, you know, that kind of thing. But, you know, on a deeper level also, like just, you know, I think I like the college age because it's such an age of discovery. They've left their homes for the first time probably, you know, starting to figure out who they are, you know, their separate identity, and how they put that into form, how they interact with each other. Video is very collaborative, so they have to, you know, state their views and stick up for themselves and yield to other people. So there's a lot involved in the whole collaborative, creative process there.
Right, and you are the facilitator of that process.
Yeah.
How has your work, how have you changed over the years? What, I mean, you're not the same person you were back around 1970 when you put that first Earth Day puppet together. But how have you changed? What about your experience of life is really different now?
Mm-hmm. Well, someplace when I was approaching 40, there's a big thing for my generation about turning 30. That didn't mean anything to me. But approaching 40, when I was in my late 30s, I started thinking, gosh, what have I done? What haven't I done? All of that stuff. And I finally came up with a question for myself. Well, what haven't I done that I've wanted to do when I was younger? And what I realized was I wanted to, well, I call it video art now. Then I was saying I wanted to make visual poems as experimental media. that's really just much more dreamlike, like things that it might be a dream that you're making into a form or a combination of things, which is very poetic,
right,
and visual language. And so I started doing that, and when I, that was like late 80s or something like that. And that's what made me start teaching college full time. I'd been working for corporations and companies, educational things in New York, doing writing, producing, directing, mm-hmm. and speech writing for CEOs. And I just felt I was tired of doing other people's stories and I needed to do my own. So luckily I got a full-time college job without understanding how hard that was at that point. It was just, okay, it happened.
But and you had a really neat set of skills.
I did. And then I started doing that. Like, and the first one I made thinking, well, okay, this will be my demo for maybe getting grants. I understood about grants and stuff for getting grants in the future. But the first one just did really well because it was a very powerful piece. And with my friend who is my Haitian dance teacher. Uh-huh. She is Haitian American. And so it was a beautiful piece with her in it, but it was about her working in the corporate world and not being seen for who she was and having this whole life as this powerful spirit dancer. And in the corporate world, you know, she was a woman of color who was, you know, disregarded and not taken seriously. And so it turned out that film did really well. It got a lot of major grants and got shown all around the world. And so it changed life for me. And so I think that asking myself, what haven't I done that I always wanted to do? What haven't I done yet? You know, that kind of if not now, when question.
Yeah. So you were about 40 when you asked that.
Yeah, approaching.
And then how long was it before you got to put the film together?
Just a few years later, yeah.
And what have you done, kind of since then? Have you stopped and asked that same question again, or was that kind of a turning point? And the other ones have been different.
Yeah, well, I kept making films and videos, video art and documentaries, and people kept asking if I was going to make one about water, and I said no. There's plenty out there already, but I've gone to Bali a lot and very taken with the ceremonies and rituals there, and water is sacred to them. And on some subconscious level, I realized that and started going back and documenting, you know, and participating in all these ceremonies and rituals with water. And so I have Sacred Waters of Bali, which I show in my water class, and mm-hmm. the students get right away this culture sees water in a different way than we do. Right. So I think that bringing all the things together, you know, like mm-hmm. the creative part and the political part and the opening people's eyes part. I guess it's been about synthesis, like, you know, mm-hmm. having how I bring things together and so life feels cohesive, not a separate piece here and a separate piece there.
We kind of, there's a need to integrate and make it whole. When did you first go to Bali?
I went in 1985 to study shadow puppets because uh-huh. I was a puppeteer, and I'd done all different kinds of puppets. But there it's part of the religion, mm-hmm. and the Dalang is just under the priest, and it's part of the ceremonies. So I studied. It was very different Bali then, very, very undeveloped. Mm-hmm. No electricity, just some generators, no phones, few motor scooters. And I had two sentences in Indonesian before I went, which is Sayamal Berbichar Wayang Kulit. I want to study the Wayang Kulit, the shadow puppets, mm-hmm. in Apa Ini Dalang. Where is the Dalang? And I just kept asking this over and over again. Within a half an hour, I was at the Dalang's house, sitting on his porch with his grandchildren giving me tea. And I learned very much about Balinese culture then. You just wait and sit and wait. And they call it rubber time. So, uh-huh. But it was wonderful.
So that was your first experience. When mm-hmm. did you, and you went back and...
I went back in 87, and that time my husband came with me. He studied music, and I studied dance that time, Legong dance, mm-hmm. and which is also a part of the religion. And then I didn't go back till 2011. I was invited to be part of an environmental film festival as a participant and a workshop leader. And they invited me, and I was really happy. And at the end, they said, and it's in Bali. So I was just thrilled. And by then, I was doing my work with water, so I brought my camera and started you know, filming the ceremonies and learning about them. Then I went 2013 on my sabbatical for 2 months, and I thought that would take care of it. And then I went back 2015. I took a leave for 4 months and was in Bali. And I wasn't planning on going back again, but a friend invited me to come to Vietnam, and it's so close to Bali. Right. So I'll be back there in March.
So what is it that pulls you back? Mm-hmm. Yeah. What has you?
It's a culture that where art and spirit is part of life 24 hours a day. There's all the rest of it too, all the usual human stuff, but mm-hmm. they don't even have a word for art. It's just that much part of the culture. Uh-huh. And the spirit, there are ceremonies every day, all the time. I mean, for some people, when you get to know people, you know, you understand it's too much. They get a little tired of them, but
right.
but it's part of it's there. It's part of the culture, and people are very committed to it. It's not even committed. That's not the right word.
It's just what they do.
It's what they do.
Yeah, I mean, there are ways in which you could be a certain kind of Christian practice where it would be throughout the day, but we're so far from that kind of conscious life and the kind of. And there's often a lot of theater or drama. I mean, we call it theater because, but it would be called worship, you mm-hmm. know, which is in effect what you're describing.
Yeah. And the dance, like, I mean, my background is in theater. My parents met as actors, and so I grew up with theater and the arts. But dance has been my main expression, mm-hmm. and theater and dance were rituals. They were all, like you're saying, they were just part of the drama. They weren't something separate that you sat in a little space with the audience separate. It's all part of it. And main dance that I did for like 50 years is African dance. Mm-hmm, and, mm-hmm. you know, you're not an observer. Everybody's a participant. You're a drummer or you're a dancer or you're both, you know.
Right. And you just happened to find a cultural niche halfway around the world where it got integrated in a way that just was almost completely intuitive. Wow. wow. You also wanted us to play some songs, but to represent, to reflect some of your traveling. What should we play? The Carnaval or the Maria, the Maritza song? Or
yeah, either of those.
One?
Well, Maritza is a great singer, and
okay.
the lyrics, I don't know Portuguese much, but it's something about. My soul, who am I? Tell me who I am and tell me where to go.
Uh-huh,
so it's uh-huh. a song to the soul.
Okay, here we go.
O meu canto é o meu sonho, morreu, meu amor. Meu amor, eu sou o povo, sou mais longe do que eu.
Listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report, and our guest on this hour is Mara Alper. So Mara, you've been working on a project on forgiveness. There is probably no skill that's more important for a human being to have than forgiveness. How did you come to it? What are you trying to do with it?
I came to it as a healing process, as a way to heal, mm-hmm. and from difficulties that I had in childhood that I realized were just affecting my whole life, and it came to a head in my early 40s when some events happened with an employer that I had. It just kind of brought back some of the childhood things which related to sexual abuse, and I just started my own process of trying to get past it.
Mm-hmm.
And the first thing I understood, not immediately, it took quite a while, was that whatever anger and hatred I felt towards, you know, this person who'd wronged me, was just keeping me really connected to them in an unhealthy way.
Keeping you
way.
Connected to them and keeping you in a negative space.
Right. And just having anger, you know, that mm-hmm. became very generalized in some ways. And there's a saying, if you don't hand it back, you pass it on.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, the handing it back was not the essential part to me, although that was part of it, but it was more, how do I heal from this anger?
Uh-huh.
And hurt, of course, because I think anger is a mask for hurt.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just started to pursue that, and it kind of had to do with thinking about the other person, understanding what had led them to be who they were and act the way they acted. And that's a huge thing, but I realize, maybe because of my own life experience, but compassion and empathy I could say always, because my sister was born with a congenital hearing loss, a profound mm-hmm. hearing loss in both ears, and so I spent time thinking about what was her life like. You know?
Right.
Of course, when we look back at our childhood, she doesn't see me as being that empathetic, compassionate person so much. I was just the older sister, you know,
right.
who
right.
was
and
doing
she,
stuff.
She had her own struggle, and
yeah.
that, you were across the divide.
Yeah. yeah, but I think that was, my guess is that that's how it started, but at any rate, so when I started to make progress with that, I made a documentary about it. I've made a couple of documentaries that have to do with my life experiences, and I, in the process of making the documentary, first of all, I called it advanced art therapy. You know, mm-hmm, I was doing this art therapy for myself. But I found a man, Robert Enright, out in Wisconsin, Madison, Wisconsin, whose beliefs about forgiveness fit with what mine, and it had to do with empathy being at the core of it. Like, one that you considering forgiving somebody does not make what they did right
absolutely.
At all. Yeah. It doesn't let them off the hook. And people who don't believe in forgiveness, that's usually why, because they think it means it's saying what the other person did was okay.
Right.
Because what I found in making the documentary, I did all these person on the street interviews with people, you know, do you believe in forgiveness? What do you think about forgiveness? Wherever I traveled, I just did them. So I interviewed like probably 90 people, and I discovered there's no gray area. Either people believe in forgiveness or they don't. It's not one or the other.
Right.
And more believe in it than not. But those that don't are very, you know,
very clear.
No.
Yeah.
But I think it's because they think it's forgive and forget. They don't want to forget, or it lets the person off the hook.
A free pass rather than
right.
Yeah.
Right. But the point in this is that you forgive for your own benefit. It's really, it's actually selfish, and we don't like to say selfish, like that's a bad thing, but it's for yourself. It's to release you from that connection to the other person. Right. And so you can go on with your life and not be trapped by it.
Yeah. So how you've described it intellectually, how do you evoke it in your film, how was it drawn? How did you discover that it's about your becoming whole? You know, what happened?
Good question. I felt I regained myself. That's when I started making the video art. I felt like I felt that all the energy I had put into suppressing.
So the Haitian dancer
things,
was part of this healing.
Dior Dance was part of it, and she is a wonderful dance teacher.
Yeah.
Pat Hall, wonderful dance teacher, wonderful person. And I've been dancing with her since the early 80s, so, and this was like around early 90s when it happened.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I just felt like I was returned to myself. All this energy that had been spent in suppressing things and not remembering things and, you know, being angry was suddenly freed up. It was a huge amount of energy that I could just put into creative work.
Mm-hmm. But many people, when they put it into the creative work, then they create another layer of not knowing. But you seem to hold that as a healing.
It was healing, yeah. Yeah, because in that documentary, in that video art, it's called Silent Echoes, there's a point where she leans into the top man that she's working for.
Mm-hmm.
And she in real life worked for Armand Hammer at Occidental Petroleum. So, and I was working at JCPenney's doing stuff and speeches for their presidents, CEOs and all. But she leans in and she whispers in his ear, and you don't hear it. There's no words in this thing. It's just music and sounds. And she whispers a word to him, and he turns and looks at her in horror. And I've always asked audiences when I screen it, you know, what do you think she said to him? And, you know, people guess things. But the word she says to him is compassion. And his response, the direction I gave him, and I can't say it on air, was to say, F you, as
right.
if she'd said that to him, but
right.
she was really saying compassion
right.
to him. So that piece was about, you know, people and being seen, and in the end, they did see her, and she released them into dance. So it was a piece about healing and having your own sense of self.
Wow. Was the industrialist Armand Hammer her boss?
He was her boss. She was the administrative, you know, top executive secretary, whatever
right.
to him.
Yeah, he was an. I mean, he was a fascinating guy, too, in his own right, and the connections with the Soviet Union and all sorts of stuff. But she sounds like forces to be reckoned with that had a reckoning.
Mm-hmm.
In real life, did it work that way?
How so?
Was she able to really engage him in the workplace in a way that changed things the way it did in the film?
Well, we both left those jobs not long after, but,
you
know.
Yeah. I mean, it's you change and you move on.
Yeah.
I'm just kind of, this, we have come to many places in this hour, and we kind of come there, and I don't quite know where they go, but they're just there, and that's fine. There's a rhythm to it that I haven't fully understood. How did you? And maybe it's a style. Maybe it's a working style where you work with something until you get it, and then it's gone, or then you move on to the next thing. Not that it's gone, but it's no longer something to be concerned about. Because you've done that work and you carry it with you or whatever. Forgiveness for a lot of people works that way, is once you've done the work of forgiveness around whatever the core issue was or the set of issues that have constrained your life with anger or with loss or sorrow or whatever version of that, then you kind of don't have to do it again.
Well, I think because I'm a teacher at heart, I've been doing workshops on forgiveness. Sure. I do day long workshops for people, with people, and talk about it when it comes up, you know, individually with people. So, and forgiveness is never ending. You have to practice it every day, you know. And there's so many opportunities.
So many things that come up every day. Yeah.
So I think I'm still very. Dedicated to it in terms of I just see the benefit it's had for me and other people who practice it. It's a practice, you know. And so
and I find once something is resolved, I don't think about it except maybe once a decade or, you know, once every 5 years it may come up as something. Oh, that's where I was back then. I'm not there anymore. Isn't that interesting? Or or I'm grateful. You know, and tying some of the themes together that you've raised.
Well, I think there are ripple effects. Like, there's other ways that you see things come up, like neediness or fears or, you know, just ongoing things where you say, oh, I see how that goes back.
Yeah, you're a little unglued because there was a time when you were really unglued. Mara, it's been wonderful to get to know you. This hour has just gone. What should we close with? Should we close with Leonard Cohen?
Yeah, let's do that. In honor of him, and because it's a great song.
Yeah.
And the line, that's where the light gets in. There's a crack in everything. That's where the light gets in.
Yes. What is it? Give up your perfect imaginings? Or something like that. I mean, that's the lead-in line. But yeah. Thank you, Mara.
Thank you.
They sing at the break of day. Start again, I heard them say. Don't dwell on what has passed away or what is yet to be. Thank you. you've summoned up a thundercloud. They're gonna hear from me. Ring the bell that's still to ring. Forget your perfect offering. Up the mind.